welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, do you have what it takes to be an ISA millionaire? We get some tips from a 36-year-old, yes, you heard that right, a 36-year-old, who's achieved it. Plus, there's a new easy access Best Buy, Lee will tell you all about it, and an NS&I savings account that has got the This Is Money saving expert rather excited. But you need to get your skates on if you want to take advantage. Also today, trouble in the housing market ahead of the budget as data shows a huge spike in house price cuts and abandoned sales. But in better news, more cuts to mortgage rates. And are you sitting on a retro gadget gold mine? Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a message from our sponsors. Do you love talking about money as much as you like listening to it? Well, Charles Stanley Direct's financial coaching service gives you a real human, yes, an actual expert to help you make sense of your finances. No jargon, no pressure, just clear answers to your money questions. Book your free 15-minute call today at charles-stanley.co.uk/financial-coaching. Go on, your future self will thank you. Remember, investment involves risk. Now back to the show. ISA speculation continues to rumble on ahead of the budget with, as we know, the Chancellor very keen to get us to stuff less into cash savings and more into stocks and shares, saying it's better for our money and it's better for the economy. Well, one piece of data gives a bit of a boost to her argument. It is the number of people who've become ISA millionaires, including, as I mentioned at the top of the show, a 36-year-old. Am I right in saying, Lee, 100% from investing?
Yeah, totally from investing.
There we go. Ollie Perry is the 36-year-old and is just one of almost 5,000 ISA millionaires, reaching the seven-figure milestone on contributions of £206,000 that he made over 11 years. And you guys spoke to him. So, ISA millionaires, 5,000, almost 5,000, and one a 36-year-old. That'd be all right, wouldn't it?
It's not a bad going, is it, Georgie? I should point out that 4,850 investors that are ISA millionaires is actually a data set from 2022. That is the most up-to-date figures that HMRC have. So the likelihood is that there's probably a fair few more that have managed to join the club between then and now. And Ollie is one of those that has joined that club in that meantime. He hit this ISA millionaire mark in 2024. As you say, £206,000 that he started investing 11 years ago. His annualized returns during this period have been 20%, double the S&P 500. Pretty good going. Now, the reason why I really like this story is because of Ollie's age. I think it's really interesting that, you know, I think we're in the danger of when we think about ISA millionaires, it's people that have held ISA since they began in 1999 and the previous product before that, including Lord Lee, who we've interviewed before and we've mentioned in this story, who was sort of claimed to be UK's first ISA millionaire. But this is, Ollie is now 37 and he got in touch with us at the start of the month. Not to boast, he didn't want to be like, look at me, I'm an ISA millionaire. He actually got in touch because he wanted to kind of shine a light on his story and say, hey, look, it's not completely outside the realms of possibility to do this. There's a couple of massive caveats to it, though, that you need to know about. And the first one is the likelihood is you will need to be able to max out your ISA allowance every year. For many people, that is just simply implausible. £20,000, I think something like 96% of people don't use the full ISA allowance every year, the people that actually do use part of their wrapper. That's a pretty big hurdle. But I know that there's a lot of listeners and a lot of readers that do potentially max out their ISA allowance or could max out their ISA allowance if they wanted to. And actually, when Mr. Perry started in 2013, the ISA allowance was £11,280. It went up to £11,520 in 2013-14, it went up a little bit more. And it's been 20 grand since 2017-18. But his investments have basically outperformed a lot, and the second thing I should point out here is there's a lot of risk. But what I'll do is I'll go through it, the tips that he gave and how it worked. Right, so the first tip he gave was learn about investing and what you're investing in. I think it helps that Ollie is a former financial advisor and a consultant, and went to London School of Economics in 2009. So he clearly already has a base knowledge of how the economy works, how money works, which is crucial when we talk about financial education all of the time. And he said traditional newspapers like the FT, we'll give a shout out to the FT, that's fine. And reading This Is Money, books, podcasts also helps him in the beginning. And he didn't himself take any financial advice. He just wanted to do his own research. And he sort of strategy was focused on individual stock picking in industries he understood. And he said, before you even start to put £10 in an ISA, do some research about investments. There's a lot of value in understanding how stocks are performed, what inflation is, and how it erodes the value of money. He says, if I was starting again today, I would go and search for peers and people making podcasts in the financial space to get ideas. Yeah, I think what he's saying here is just keep reading, keep learning, keep listening. Individual stock picking can be risky, and I think a lot of people, especially novice investors, will prefer the safety of getting it into a product that spreads risk and has lots of companies in one big package. But sometimes, you know, fortune does favour the brave. And the second tip it gives is to fully use your stocks and shares allowance. We've just gone through that. Number three is to be brave for market beating growth. Again, this taps into a little bit of the risk-taking element of this. Because one thing that ISA millionaires definitely have in common is that they've made some astute and you could possibly say lucky investments over the years. It's very unlikely that those that have got £1 million have been invested in index trackers, for example. It's more likely there's been some success stories along the way, gains locked in, got out. And as we point out in this, we've had things like dot-com bubble, people, you know, potentially made a lot of money out of that and exited at the right time. And actually he goes on to talk about here one of the bravest things that he did involves Bitcoin, actually. And I know that a lot of listeners like to hear about Bitcoin successes and things. He had Strategy, which is MSTR, world's largest corporate owner of Bitcoin. It announced in August 2020 its plans to build a massive Bitcoin treasury. And he jumped in December 2020 because it could be held in an ISA at that time. Made some good gains off of that. But I think the biggest thing he did, the bravest thing, the Smarter Web Company, which I think we've discussed on this podcast in the past. It was a UK design firm that pivoted towards becoming its own Bitcoin treasury. It IPO'd in 2024. Ollie's ISA provider didn't list the stock immediately, so he initially bought it in a standard stocks and shares account and later purchased it in his ISA at an average of 28p. He says, the share soared to over 600p amid Bitcoin treasury hype. I sold 97% of my ISA holding at 260p, sending some shares too early, some at the top and some on the way down, netting around £400,000 in realised profits over 2 months. Inside his ISA wrapper, lovely jubbly. I mean, that could have blown up in his face, like easily could have blown up in his face. And but the more sensible things that he'd done, he says other bets that paid off included investing relatively early in the Mag 7 stocks, Alphabet, Amazon, Microsoft. He said between 2013 and 2024, Amazon's up 800%, Microsoft 700%, Alphabet 400%. It is an exercise in a bit of risk and a bit of bravery. And as he points out here in point number four, is preparing for mistakes along the way. He said, investing in over 50 stocks and ETFs over the past decade and a bit has taught me plenty through trial and error. One mistake, he said, was investing in certain commodities that perform poorly despite exciting trends. I'm guessing he hasn't jumped on the gold hype or 25, which has seen it go up somehow 60%, although some of the steam has kind of come off of that. And he also said that he was expected to do better off of the kind of commodities needed to build electric cars. So rare earths, copper, nickel, minerals. He just expected it to do better than what it's done. And he's learned from his mistakes of that. And then number five, he really reiterates about being willing to take some risks. He said, leaning too heavily on ETFs was a misstep, partly for their lower volatility through diversification, but also due to laziness. Spreading bets across ETFs is safer, but it diluted my returns. Picking specific winners could have multiplied my gains. This brings up a broader lesson, diversification versus picking and holding winners. I would really point out here that this is quite, I would say, not novice investing. I think that basically there's three types of people who hold money, I would say. There's the people that just aren't willing to invest whatsoever and want to hold it all into cash, which is where the Chancellor is trying to push people potentially into investing more There's talks again about the cash ISA limit being cut after it was on. It seemed to be, the rumours seemed to be building at the start of the year, got cut down. Now the rumours are building back up again that this could potentially happen. And you're going to be strong arming those people into investing. And I think the next set of people are the kind of tentative investors, those people that are willing to dip a toe in. They've kind of heard success stories from friends that may be in a Vanguard or an AJ Bell or something like that, that tracks, Life Strategy or something like that, that has plenty of diversification in there. And they've seen pretty healthy gains, especially versus saving in cash. And then I think you get people like Ollie that are kind of taking that next step and they fully immerse themselves into the world of investing. They read all of the fact sheets. They go through everything. They pick out individual shares. They're willing to take the risk and willing to lose money. Because let's face it, we always see those warning signs on investment products. You know, capital at risk, investment can go down. We know all that. I mean, there's no risk on a savings product, a cash ISA product, saying, warning, this might be eroded by inflation. But we are used to seeing the investing warnings. And I think that people are fearful. If you've got £50,000 and you take a big gamble on it and it turns to £10,000, then you're going to be sick about it, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
But if you turn £50,000 into £200,000, you kind of think you're like the Wolf of Wall Street, like, you know, you're kind of managing to outperform the market. So I would treat this story with a bit of caution. Don't just go off and start picking individual stocks and getting into Bitcoin and all that. You have to arm yourself with as much knowledge as possible. But the reason why we shone the spotlight on this week is because there has been a lot of financial doom and gloom around lately, George, I would say. You know, talks about what could be in the budget, whether we're going to see middle classes attacked again, and middle earners and higher earners for that as well. And also impending stock market Armageddon, again, which doesn't help sow the seed for people to start investing. But I mean, FTSE 100 has been touching record highs this week. Is there going to be a big global stock market correction? You know, it's hard. And actually, I was thinking about it. There was that blip in April, the AI blip, where all markets, everything went into freefall and panic. And then it all sort of clawed back. It all got wiped back on pretty quickly. And I don't know if people got stung by that. Don't know if people exited, etc. But there is a lesson in that, in riding out the storms and thinking about investing on over the long term. And that's what I'm getting at with this is, there's obviously been some short-term gains in Ollie's portfolio here, but it's very dangerous game playing the short-term game when you're investing. Loads of food for thought. I don't think being an ISA millionaire is completely out in the realms of possibility. I think there's way more people that are potential ISA millionaires now, just because the £20,000 annual wrapper has been around for, what, 6-7 years? And people are on. There's a lot of smart people out there that have managed to build up a nice tax-free buffer. I started thinking, Georgia, this is my last thought, okay? Started thinking, what if the Charles actually attacked how much you could hold overall in your ISA wrapper? Like, what if they just hacked out? You can, £1 million is the maximum you can have in there, and then we just killed off the ISA millionaire notion. Not outside the realms of possibility, completely made up by me, but you can see how things like that could come to fruition.
It'd be rubbish, because these are gifts of articles, aren't they? Talking to ISA millionaires. Simon, I want to talk to you a bit about risk. Lee was there talking about risk and taking elements of risk. The reason I mention that is because I've, over the last couple of weeks, had a couple of chats with some fund managers. And one actually last night, who was at the Treasury, said that risk, or the concepts around risks, the fear that Lee was talking about, is the biggest thing holding people back. And we know that they've been mooting the suggestion of perhaps softening the language, shall we say, of some of these investment vehicles, maybe to sound less scary. But the other one was thinking about risk in a different way. And I was listening to a podcast about this, is you think about what your goal is, and let's say that's retirement, and you think, what would be the biggest risk to me getting there? And if you're thinking about that way, you'd probably say, well, it's cash, isn't it? So is there something about the way that we need to think about risk? And if so, what on earth, if it is what's holding us back, can we do to make people feel more comfortable with it?
It's a very good question. And before I answer it, I will say, first of all, hats off, Ollie. Great work. Bravo. I am phenomenally impressed. I've been investing for longer than you, and I'm nowhere near being an ISA millionaire. I think the key bit here is, as Lee said, he's used his whole ISA allowance, but he has also taken some pretty big bets with some pretty large amounts of money. That Smarter Web Company one, wow, that really did pay off. And the place you would have heard about the Smarter Web Company first? This Is Money. We had the exclusive story on the fact that the Smarter Web Company was planning on doing this. Andrew Webley of the Smarter Web Company got in touch with us, got in touch with me like at the tail end of last year to tell us about it. And it was a good story. And we were always very clear in the stories that this was super high risk. I mean, if you think investing in Bitcoin is high risk, then investing in Bitcoin treasury companies, it takes that and like magnifies it some. I mean, MicroStrategy, when it was booming, was described as Bitcoin on steroids, right? So it's super high risk. Could have gone the other way. So when you do, or if you do put a large amount of money into something like that, you need to be prepared for that to have gone in completely the opposite direction. And actually, if anybody bought into Smarter Web Company when those shares were at their peak, they would now be down by quite a lot. So you've got to be very careful about that stuff. And the bigger the bet you make, the larger your losses could be, but also the larger your gains. And I said bet, but that's really the wrong word. It's an investment, isn't it? But if you're investing in something like a small web company that said it's now going to transition to being a Bitcoin treasury company, I think that's where you start crossing over from the investment to bet element. But the research had been done there by the founder of the company. And he said, look, this does not exist in the UK. There's no listed way to get access to Bitcoin in the UK. It has worked for MicroStrategy, now called Strategy. It should work here. There will be the interest. Okay. So he'd done a lot of, you know, this wasn't just some pie in the sky idea, right? So obviously we researched this properly before we wrote about it, but that is like at the extreme end of the kind of risk. And at the other end, you've got doing the sensible thing, putting your money into a global stock market tracker fund. But in a global stock market tracker fund, you'd have done super well over the last, you know, 10 years, because it's been driven by the US, which has been driven by the Magnificent Seven, which have seen like stratospheric share price gains. So you do need to be aware that the one thing that has happened here is that Ollie has managed to very successfully, and much better than I've done, ride the wave of a very strongly rising market. But that's a market that's also seen COVID in the middle of it and the crash then. But what's been really interesting is whenever we've seen corrections, probably over, you know, stretching back certainly to COVID, that COVID one, and maybe before that, is you're starting to see the corrections come really hard and fast after the initial crash. And I wonder whether that has, for some people, dialed down their perception of the risk that there might be. Because if you look back, for example, to the dot-com boom and bust, it took a long time for some of those companies to get anywhere near back to the level that they were. And if you look at the FTSE 100, it took donkey's years for it to get back to its peak. But to go to your question about risk and do people take enough risk after me talking about lots of risk there, no, they don't. And we think about investment risk in a very different way to the way we think about other risks in our life. We take risks all the time. Moving job is a risk. Moving home is a risk. Having kids is a risk. Leaving the house is a risk, fundamentally. We manage to do most of those on a daily basis. And we might take, you know, bigger risks. Some people might like to, you know, take part in action sports or things like that. Or you know, people might go, oh, I'm going to do a charity skydive. But I bet you there's people out there who've done charity skydives but will say, oh, I'm not investing, it's too much risk. I tell you what, there is a lot of people out there doing. There's a lot of people out there putting really expensive SUVs on finance deals, right? On PCP finance deals. And they're buying cars that, you know, the list price is like £60,000. And then they pay the depreciation over the next 3 years, for example. And they are pretty much guaranteed to lose about £25,000 on that car over 3 years. So they're willingly lose 25 grand over 3 years on a car But lots of those people might say, I don't want to invest. It's too much risk. And that's the thing that we need to change. And I don't necessarily think sometimes the risk warnings help. I don't think half the time people even look at the risk warnings. But I think there is this thing where we need to, and this is the thing that the government really needs to do rather than attacking the cash ISA won't help. What that will do is that will sow the seed in the mind of lots of people. Well, you know what? There's no point because they'll only change the rules on you. That's what people say about pensions as well. Well, there's no point putting money in your pension. They'll only change the rules on you. And that is from years of people changing the rules. They'll only come and raid it. This mentality stops people doing things. And if they do that to the ISA, which is, you know, our most successful financial product, then it will only lead to people going, well, what's the point? They'll only come for the stocks and shares ISA next. So I think that would be the wrong thing. But trying to get across to people that idea of like, you could make some money here. And the longer term thing, I think that's what you need to do. And you need to use some of those statistics, you know, like there's lots of reports that talk about this. For example, there's the Barclays Equity Guilt Study, comes out every year, very, very in depth. And if you look over longer periods, so over 10-year time periods, and it's done every 10-year time period, going back 120 years, maybe even longer. Basically, once you get to that 10-year time period, your chance of losing money is absolutely minute. And actually, your chance of making above inflation gains is much greater. And investing has been proven to be the way of making above inflation gains. But I don't know how we get this message across to more people, because we're trying to get this message across to people all the time. And I think success stories like Ollie's are important. I do think that I wouldn't advocate that the average person does this, because you've got to be totally dedicated to this. But I think, you know, more of that stuff around like, well, you know, I invested £200 a month and I did it for 5 years and now I've got this great pot and I'm on my way is the kind of thing that we need to be talking to people about. Amongst the FTSE 100 companies, for example, BAE shares are up 60% this year. Rolls-Royce, one of our most famous names in engineering and not related to the car company, which is a common mistake. I think those shares have doubled over the last year. You know, there are British stock market success stories. Now, the difficulty is like, ideally, you don't want people going out and just putting all their money in Rolls-Royce, because when Rolls-Royce shares fall by 30%, they've lost 30%. But it's that thing about, well, you know what? It's about spreading your risk, and it's about, you know, taking a bit of risk, and it will pay off. And one day you'll thank yourself for it. And you know, yes, not everything will go right. But we know that in life, to go back to my original point, not everything goes right. We make bad decisions all of the time. Sometimes it was a mistake to buy that house. That's an expensive mistake. Sometimes it was a mistake to take that job. Sometimes...
go out with that man.
Yeah. Sometimes I leave the house and I think it was a mistake doing that. But, you know, we chalk it up to experience. We go, do you know what? I'm going to learn from that mistake. I'm going to try not to make it again. I mean, we all repeatedly make the same mistake, don't we? But, you know, I think it is the mentality thing. But I do agree with your point of we need to change how people think about risk and encourage them to take a bit more risk. And everything that has, the way the system has been set up over the last 15, 20 years has been to discourage people from doing that. And this has come at the same time as you have seen financial advice completely fall out of the experience of the vast majority of, you know, kind of middle class people who might have some money to invest, because of changes in the way advisors are paid, and it's no longer common to have financial advice. So you don't have those advisors helping people over that hurdle of starting to invest.
But we do have a load of apps now to make it so much easier to invest. We're moving in the right direction. Lee, Simon there spoke about what's not going to work, and that's probably cutting the cash ISA limit or making big changes to the cash ISA to get everybody investing. However, Lee, I do want to ask, because you mentioned it in your newsletter, some of the sort of ideas being mooted around, what's on the table?
Yeah, so we've gone back to putting the ISA back in on the table. The ISA was on the table, it was moved off the table, and now it's back on the table again. A couple of things that we kind of hear rumours of, outside of potentially the cash ISA limit being slashed, British ISA Oh, Georgie, there's
how is that back? How is it back?
There's reports the British ISA is sorry, I'm trying not to laugh at this just because we kind of spoke about it quite a lot when the Conservatives were in power. They got quite sort of fixated on it, and then as soon as Labour came into power, it was like meh. And now it seems to be back, which is given an extra £5,000 tax-free allowance to invest in UK-listed companies. It was scrapped by Labour on the grounds that it would overcomplicate ISAs. But the Treasury is obviously very keen on UK investment to have a boost, a shot in the arm. And there's some way, shape or form that the British ISA could make its way back into the plans of the government. There's another rumours, apparently Treasury is weighing up whether Sabre should be forced to hold a minimum amount of UK company shares or funds or in their ISAs. Apparently city figures are pushing for a minimum allocation of 25% to 50%. I think the reason for this is because, especially in recent years, a lot of people have heavily invested in the US. British money has gone into US companies because of the Magnificent Seven, because we've seen such fantastic gains in some of the companies that are there in the S&P 500. I think the government are saying, hey, hold on a minute, this should be going to UK companies. In theory, I understand the logic. Very difficult to police, very difficult to actually implement. And forcing people into doing something quite often backfires and doesn't do the thing that they were expecting to do. Axing stamp duty on London shares. So investors currently pay tax when they buy shares electronically. It's called stamp duty with a reserve tax. Costs 0.5% of the price you pay for the shares. Talking about getting rid of that, it wouldn't cost a huge amount of money. I think when we think of stamp duty, we think of the property market. We think of the billions of pounds that raises for the Treasury. It's actually quite small fry. It's almost like 120 million quid or something like that. You know, so there's talks about basically just getting rid of that. Again, I'm not convinced it'll do an awful lot. I don't think it would make a huge amount of difference. Anything, though, that would make investing easier, making investing in UK companies more attractive, should be on the table, though, and should be looked at. It's the forcing, strong-arming people into doing things that I kind of take a little bit of kind of umbrage with. And that's why I'm very firmly in the camp of, well, I'm not sure cash ISAs, the allowance should be cut. There's a couple of reasons for it. One of them being, it's one of a financial product that people actually know about, trust, understand, and moving the goalposts, probably not great, but it wouldn't affect an awful lot of people because hardly anyone maxes out their allowance, as I said at the top of the show. And for example, someone like me, it wouldn't really affect me because I'd kind of do an 80-20 split of investing to cash anyway. But there are a lot of people that park money in cash ISAs for a whole wave of reasons, not just because they don't want to invest, but it might be because they're going to use it for something within that 5-year period I was talking about earlier. So they don't want to take any risk investing. They just kind of know what they're doing with that money. I just don't think it's the right move, personally. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't think it will make an awful lot of difference. The real key, Georgie, and the real thing I think about this is just having the choice over our financial decisions, I think, is absolutely crucial. Yeah, the other thing I should also point out here, Georgie, is that, you know, let's face it, 10 years ago, we couldn't save £20,000 into an ISA. It is quite a good product. It has been ramped up to a point where, you know, there are a lot of people that are wealthy that are maxing this out and doing very well for themselves with it. And I guess that's where the argument lay. You know, there are, we again said at the top of the show, there's nearly 5,000 people that are ISA millionaires. If I had to put a stab at that, I would have thought that has probably doubled or tripled since 2022. That's a real just stab in the dark figure. That's quite a large chunk of people that are managing to keep their cash tax-free. Mm-hmm. And I think actually in that set of data from HMRC, there was something like 25 super investors that had more than £8 million in their ISAs. I think we talked about it earlier in the year, mm-hmm, when that data, mm-hmm, came out on the podcast. We're talking about the wealthy paying a fairer share, even though you could argue that the wealthy already pay quite a fair share of tax. But again, that goes back to my point of, could there be a lifetime cap on what's kept in an ISA? So all those things mixed up, you can see why it's a bit of a quandary for the Chancellor.
Well, we've still got a ways to go, Leah. Still got a ways to go, a month to go. We've got a lot covering the show. Just want to quickly get some savings accounts. No, it's not all about investing, Leah. Some savings accounts here. Zopa launching a table-topping easy access account rate of 4.7%. Meanwhile, your savings expert, Sylvie Morris, getting rather excited about a new account from NS&I, but warning, you may have to move pretty quickly if you want to take advantage. Leah, just sum up what's going on out there.
Oh, you know I love a bit of savings news, George.
I know.
Now I love it. So yeah, Zopa, I've got a easy access rate paying 4.75%, but you need to open its current account. I have it. The current account is called Biscuit. There's actually a couple of people on the team that have got that account and said that it seems pretty good. You do also need to have paying at least £500 a month into that Zopa easy access. I'm pointing out here that this is not an ISA. This is just a run-of-the-mill easy access account. So if you do earn too much interest and you're a high rate taxpayer, additional rate taxpayer, or even a basic rate taxpayer, you've got to be careful not to breach your personal savings allowance. But that said, currently that is the best easy access rate. There's a couple of sort of 4.4% out there, but Zopa really sort of come out fighting with that easy access account. And actually, I think it's quite clever linking it to the current account, because there's a lot of data out there suggesting that people like to save alongside their current account and like to keep their money with it. And I would look at it as an alternative to the big banks who are offering easy access rates linked to current accounts of 1%, one measly, horrible, horrific 1%. So well worth a look. And then the NS&I account that Sylvia's talking about here is a one-year fix paying 4.04%. It looks like an increasingly good deal, and there's only one account that currently beats it, which is Co-op Bank at 4.09%. I did check before we recorded the podcast that NS&I account was still there, because it's very unusual for NS&I to be table topping, and when it does tables, it shuffles down a lot, so it doesn't take in too much money and breach its financing targets. So if you are after a fix, that NS&I account is a good one. And of course, one of the big boons of NS&I is that all the money is protected by the government rather than the £85,000 financial services compensation scheme limit, which is per banking license at the others. There are also a couple of other 4%. Coventry and Leeds Building Societies have both got a 4% one-year fix. So it looks good. There are some smaller building societies. Let me shout out to the smaller building societies here, Georgie. If you've got one in your town or nearby, sometimes they're postcode linked, but Newcastle Building Society offering a 4.1% fix for a year, Loughborough 4.15%, and Bath 4.2%. If you're in those areas, well worth going to see what your building society is up to, what they're offering and what they're doing. Let's support the building societies, Georgie. I like them.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Blair Ngashi from Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Invest and Explain feature. Blair, we have a question here from a podcast listener. If I take a tax-free lump sum from my SIP, but take 15% instead of 25%, what decides how much the next 10% is worth? Is it the pension value when I take the first lump sum? Or if my investments grow the pension value when I take the second lump sum? The floor is yours.
Ili, quite a complex question there. If you only take 15% of your SIP as a tax-free lump sum now, the remaining 10% will be based on the value of your pension when you take it, okay? This means that the next portion isn't fixed at today's value. It moves with your investments. So if investments go up, the amount you can take as tax-free cash will go up. But if it falls, that 10% will be worth less. As a general rule of thumb, when it comes to pensions, your 25% tax-free cash entitlement is always a quarter of whatever your uncrystallized pot is worth. It's very important that you understand the uncrystallized pot at the time you withdraw. And this is up to the limit of the lump sum allowance, not based off the value of when you first take your tax-free cash payment.
Blair Ngashi from Charles Stanley Direct.
Welcome back. There are more signs of a faltering property market ahead of the autumn budget. Home sellers are slashing their asking prices, and there's also been a spike in the number of sales collapsing altogether. So what, Simon Lambert, is going on out there? What's the picture? Who's saying it?
So the property market, depending on where you are looking at, is not doing very well. The big issue is the parts of the property market in the most expensive areas of the country, where people paid high prices for homes 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago, pandemic boom, and are now finding that the demand is not there for those large, expensive homes anymore, particularly the ones that are further out of town. You had the race for space, you had people rushing to move out of town, you had people saying, well, I'm not going to need to be back in the office anymore, so it doesn't matter about my commute. And you had people who were also benefiting from extremely low mortgage rates. You now have the opposite of that situation occurring. You have people being expected to go back to their workplaces far more often. There's still a surprising number of people who only have to go in a couple of days a week, but most people are finding they're having to go in more often. They're also maybe finding that actually they didn't want to move out of town, and they preferred being closer to town, and they preferred not having to drive to the station and pay to park at the station and all those other things. Or they preferred being closer to the schools or the catchment areas or all these other things. They're also finding that they definitely preferred much cheaper mortgage rates. I must admit, I'm finding now, 1 month into my new mortgage, that I definitely preferred the old one. The old one was at 1.4%. The new one is at 3.95%. I did prefer that old mortgage, if I'm going to be honest. And I definitely preferred the amount of money that used to go out of my bank account compared to the amount of money that goes out of my bank account now. So you can see why people can't pay the same amount for houses anymore. We have got some data here from property data firm 20CI, and it said in the year to date, there have been 918,585 price reductions, which is a 16% jump from 791,820 in 2024, and 23% higher than the 747,873,000 recorded in 2023. So why, if we all know that the property market in those parts of the country isn't doing so well, and this is predominantly southeast, east of England, southwest. London's not as badly affected, but London didn't quite see the same pandemic boom because London house prices had already been suffering. So it is those kind of like those areas people rush to move to. Why, if we know the property market isn't doing so well, are people putting their houses on for too much money? There's a number of things going on here. First one, loss aversion. Nobody wants to sell at a loss unless it's their SUV that they bought on a PCP deal, which they're perfectly happy to do. But nobody wants to sell at a loss. Their most valuable asset, their home, nobody wants to sell that at a loss. And so they don't want to accept that it might possibly be worth less than they paid for it. And so they want to price it so that they at least break even. Or ideally, most people want to make money on houses because we are absolutely bombarded in our lives by this idea that property prices always go up.
But also, Simon, it's not just the loss of the house price. It's so expensive to buy houses. Like, imagine how much you've paid in stamp duty and moving costs and da-da-da. Add that to any drop as well.
Moving on to point B. Because you're in this boat and you want to try and get the most amount of money for your house, you're going to anchor on the price that houses around you have gone on the market for and maybe houses around you have sold for. And you're probably going to decide that your house is a bit better than they are. It's just human nature to think that. So you're probably going to think, well, I'll put a bit on. And so you end up being encouraged to maybe price a bit high. Moving on to point C. An estate agent's come around and they've given you a valuation. And maybe you've done that sensible thing where you've got three agents around and they've given you a valuation. One of them's given you a higher valuation. You've quizzed them on this. You said it's higher than the other valuations. They told you about how, you know, they know the market, they're very successful in the area, they'll definitely get it sold, definitely worth more. And you want to believe that because of perhaps points A and B. And so you put it on for a bit more money. Moving on to point D. Everybody else is doing the same thing, and it's so expensive to move, going back to your point, Georgie, that you feel that you have to put it on for as much money as possible. Otherwise, you're not actually going to be able to move home. And also, you people doing the same thing, downsizing, try to maximize their profit as well, which all comes down to the bit where there's a lot of pressure on you to just go as high as you can. And I would say my final point is people think, well, you know what? if we price it a bit high, we can allow people to negotiate a bit of a discount. I think they're getting a deal. The problem is that there's a wealth of evidence that this doesn't work. There is a wealth of evidence that suggests you're better to price realistically first time round, build up some interest, and hopefully, if you can get two buyers competing against each other, that's when you get the price up. And there's also a growing amount of data indicating that prices that go on the market too high and then have to have a reduction actually end up sitting on the shelf for longer. That people think, oh, well, there's been a reduction, so that house isn't going to sell. Must be something wrong with it. Or also sometimes they think, well, if they've reduced the price and they've made a big reduction in price, must mean that they really need to sell and they're open to negotiation. So what you get is you get a rush of people coming around to view your newly reduced house, and then you get a load of lowball offers.
How much, Lee, do you think, taking in mind what Simon just said there, how much do you think the budget specifically is playing on certain areas of the market? And with that, I'm thinking about things like wealth taxes, fears for properties over perhaps a million. Are we seeing any picture with certain types of people?
Oh,
properties?
Hugely so, Georgie. I mean, I don't think it's any secret on this podcast that I'm looking to move house. I mean, our house is sold. We're looking to go up to that, you know, up the ladder a little bit. And it's almost impossible to remain. Lots of people are kind of not listing their homes because they're kind of fearful of what's coming in the budget. And I've had numerous conversations with estate agents in recent times to that effect. I think it's had a huge, I think the uncertainty people, but when you're buying a massive asset, an expensive asset like a house, uncertainty any way, shape or form is going to hamper the market. And people have been burnt in the past. And I'm talking about things like stamp duty holidays, for example, when they've completed maybe a few days before stamp duty holidays come in and it would have made it cheaper, all of that kind of thing. I think there's a real fear in the market that over a certain price point of property, there's going to be a raft of property taxes coming in. And people are worried about that. And of course, all will be revealed roughly this time next month. And perhaps absolutely nothing will be revealed in the property market. But you only have to look at the data in this these stats by property data firm 20CI, right? So we mentioned it, almost 990,000 price reductions. That's a 16% jump on last year. And at 23% higher than 2023 compared to 2021 and 2022 when the property market was booming. It's double the amount of asking price cuts, and all of those things, those four things that I mentioned, definitely to play. I definitely think estate agents, I can certainly say from experience in this local area, are very competitive. And actually, just as Simon said it, I had three separate estate agents come value the property. Two were roughly in the same ballpark. One, a national agent, was way too high, way too unrealistic, in my opinion, of what I believe the property to be worth. But it does sew that into your head. You're like, well, maybe we should list it for that price. But you can bet your bottom dollar you'll list it at that price. You'll get hardly anyone coming through the door. And then the estate agent will say in a few weeks' time, oh, yeah, we should probably reduce it to get more interest. And it will just go down back to the price point that the sensible agents had suggested. So I think, yeah, going back to your original question, yes, the budget is definitely playing on it. And we actually spoke to Phil Spencer, the TV property expert. There's no hiding from it. This is a really tough time to be selling a home. In many parts of the country, there are more homes for sale than buyers. And until that changes, prices will stay under pressure. I personally, at the moment, I kind of I'm washing my hands of trying to find somewhere because nothing's really come into play. And I think you've got the budget. Then once it's done, it's Christmas, and you know, the people just aren't interested. And then Boxing Day, you get the boom in house listings. Perhaps if not much is going on in the budget, and in fact, you know, there is a chance that absolutely nothing goes on, we might see the Boxing Day boom, and maybe we'll see a resurgence in the property market, and everyone feels a bit more settled down. Mortgage rates are kind of still stable compared to what we've been used to in recent years. And there are reasons to be cheerful.
Bit of Christmas cheer there, Lee. Thank you. Simon, Lee mentioned their mortgage rates. Good news if you're looking for a mortgage, I suppose. Two major banks have cut theirs. Both HSBC and Barclays announced they'll be lowering rates across some of their fixed mortgage deals. Why is that? Will we see others follow suit?
been a bit of nervousness in the mortgage market recently. I mean, bear in mind, you can fix below the base rate at the moment for 5 years or 2 years if you've got a lot of equity. So mortgage rates have come down a lot, and then that's stalled, and they've gone up a little bit. What's happened here is we saw inflation figures come out this week. Inflation has stayed steady at 3.8%. This is seen as the peak of inflation. There's hope that this might encourage the Bank of England to be a bit more forthcoming with interest rate cuts. And so mortgage lenders have moved to lower their rates. Also, it's nearly the end of the year, and you do tend to see banks offering some keener mortgages in November and December time, try and get some more money in before the end of the year. People have got targets to hit and so on. So I mean, it's possible that we could see them tickle down before the end of December and even into the new year, because you normally get a similar effect at the start of the new year when you get a bit of a kind of boom, let's start the new year with some lower rates thing going on. But as Lee said, it all depends on the budget. The thing I'd be worried about if I was going to buy an expensive house right now is council tax.
Yeah.
I mean, like this, you know, the carefully middle of the road think tank, the IFS, in the report we were talking about last week, you know, they were talking about one extreme measure that Rachel Reeves could take would be to double the top two rates of council tax, band G and band H. I mean, that would be huge because you've got to pay that every month. I'm in band G. I'm paying $4,000 a month already. If it doubled, that'd be another $4,000 a year. It's a huge amount of money. You know, you look at that as a higher rate taxpayer and allowing for national insurance and everything else. You know, you've got to double what that. You've got to earn $8,000 to pay $4,000. I mean, that I've just worked out on my calculator while we were talking. It'd be about 330 something a month. So you're talking, you know, kind of pre-tax, you'd need an extra £600. That's a huge amount of money to get in, especially if your mortgage has just gone up by £500. So you could see why people might be looking at this going, I might sit on my hands until after the budget to see what happens here and just work out exactly how expensive this house is going to be. I don't know. I think so. A lot of this property stuff is, Rachel Reeves would be a lunatic to double the top two rates of council tax. I mean, that would definitely kill off the economy. That would. But then there's other stuff like, you know, this talk of like removing the capital gains tax exemption for selling properties worth more than £1.5 million. You'd start looking at that and start picking. It doesn't take long to start picking holes in it. It's a completely mad plan. There is a part of me that goes, you can dismiss all of this because those are completely mad ideas. And then there's this other little voice in my head that says, are we actually at the stage where we do start to get mad ideas and they are actually enacted? I sincerely hope not.
We were looking at a house and it was a band G this week. And it actually played in my mind of being like, we're in a nice little comfy middle of the road band D. And I saw the IFS report about council tax and I was like, I think it might be wise to wait till after the budget if we're seriously interested in it. I never thought I'd be saying this, a council tax banded property that is too high. It generally was in our conversation this week between my wife and I.
I tell you what, right? I mean, we talked about Ollie's story at the top of the show. I would like to take inspiration from that and one day fulfill my ambitions of becoming an ISA millionaire. I am not becoming an ISA millionaire if they double council tax rates. There'll be money coming out of my ISA. Welcome to the Rich People's Problems.
Well, do you know what, guys? I was going to ask you, for anyone listening is going, oh, for the love of God, two guys in band G's moaning about it, but it's quite inconsistent what your house is worth for it to be considered in a...
My house when I bought it was basically a three-bedroom chalet bungalow.
But that's the concept. That's the idea, isn't it? People have in their head when you say, oh, I'm going to Banji. Oh, well, you know, you're rich. So therefore you can afford it. No?
I think what's interesting is like some of these areas where you have incredibly low council tax, that's what causes the problem because the bands are effectively, you've got band D in the middle and we should do a show properly on council tax and how it works. You've got band D in the middle and then they stretch out beyond that. And there's a limit to how much they can change from band D. So if you look at band D, band D in one local authority, you know, might be X and band D in another local authority is Y. And there are some local authorities out there with very, very low council tax levels. And I don't really understand how they get away with it, you know, and how it works really like that. And that is, I do think potentially there is something that you could see change there. And the advantage to the government of basically increasing council tax is that it gives more money to local authorities from council tax. Therefore, the government can give less money to local authorities. And the government is currently in a position where local authorities are constantly having to come to the government saying, we need more money, because that so much costs have been lumped onto local authorities. I mean, local authorities are paying huge amounts for care, right? Which really shouldn't be on the local authority. But we'll do a proper episode on this, like where we go into it in more depth. I will stop talking about it now.
All right, let's turn on to something, a slightly happier subject. As the saying goes, I like this saying, one man's trash is another man's treasure, or woman's, either way. Could you be sitting on a retro gadget gold mine? Now, why we ask this, Lee, is because you're a bit of a, am I right in thinking I haven't made this up? Nintendo, that's the thing for you. It's not, no Sega Mega Drives or anything, just Nintendo. Atari, is that another?
Yeah, I have. I'm mainly Nintendo. Yeah, I've got all of the old retro consoles, and I've also got an Atari Jaguar, which was the...
Well, there you go.
Yeah. But this is different. This story that we've got here,
we're
talking about mobile phones here. We're talking about obsolete old mobile phones. I think there's been a trend in this sort of the kind of dumb phone chat, where maybe you could argue that modern day smartphones have got overcomplicated. They've taken over our lives. You only have to go on a tube and everyone's just sort of looking at a phone now. It like dominates everything that we do in our lives. And I think there has been a trend in people going, Matt, I don't need any of this stuff. I just need a phone that makes calls and texts. And I completely get it. And I think people, I've definitely overheard conversations in recent times talking about weaning themselves off using their phone too much. Now, what we have here is some data from Gumtree suggesting that prices of old mobile phones are skyrocketing, and some of them are becoming incredibly collectible. My favorite one in this list is the Motorola Dyna TAC 8000X. I mean, that is catchy, isn't it, Georgie? But it's one of those massive phones. And I was having this conversation in the office the other day. So can you imagine if you took one of those on the tube and
took
a phone call? Hello? Yeah, I'm on the tube.
It's like the ones, have you seen Pretty Woman? There's a scene in Pretty Woman where they're sitting in the park and he's got this massive brick next to his face, and then she turns it off. Anyway, that's what that looks like.
They can sell for up to $5,000 in a box or that. I would be very surprised if they work. But that's the conversation we're having. I've got no idea if you could actually make these work or not. And there's more phones in this. There's a Nokia N950 between $1,000 and $1,500. Orbital City Phone, $1,500 to $3,500. The BlackBerry Porsche design, £250 to £1,500. I really like the BlackBerry era. There was a couple of years of a BlackBerry era. It felt like it was like the dominant force in the market. Kind of, it felt like the working man's phone. I could take emails on the go. Look at this. Like, you know, and it kind of seems like it came and gone pretty quickly. But I've definitely got an old BlackBerry in the drawer, because a couple of months ago, I charged it up to see if it still worked. And lo and behold, it actually charged up. And it had loads of messages on it from yesteryear. It was like a nostalgic look in the past. Original Apple iPhone, you know, they can go for £100, but they can go for £10,000 if you've got probably a boxed kind of sealed version of one. And like a lot of things in the retro arena, you know, it's all about condition. It's all about having the original paperwork with it and boxes and all of that kind of thing. My poison of choice, as you say, are games consoles. I do love the old Nintendo stuff. I'm still out here in the shed office playing Nintendo GameCube with my six-year-old, because I find the graphics are like nicely cartoony without being too hyper realistic. There's no way it can connect to the internet, no dangers. Yes. It's just you plug it in, you switch it on, and within 1 to 2 minutes we're playing Mario Kart or we're playing Mario Strikers, and it's absolutely lovely. It's a nice little oasis of climb out here. But quite a lot of these phones are obsolete, don't work whatsoever, and actually the collecting of it is just people building up a collection of old phones and thinking that potentially they're only going to grow in value. And actually, some of the comments in this were quite funny. Someone said, in the real world, most of your old gadgets are worth little beyond their value. Value is recyclable junk. And then someone else said, I can understand keeping a few examples in museums or whatever, but who is sad enough to collect this obsolete stuff, and what warrants any value to it? Reality is old tech is so lacking in functionality, it has little or no value other than a modest novelty value, and there really aren't many buyers. And then someone replied, it's funny, but unless you're a collector or something yourself, you'll never understand. And then the final comment on this little thread was, well, you're right about not understanding some collectors. Came across a bloke once who collected factory clocking in machines. How sad is that? But there are little pockets of niches of what people collect and enjoy collecting. And I say, you know, go for it. It's not
crack on.
And if you enjoy collecting old mobile phones, you enjoy collecting old mobile phones. I enjoy collecting old Nintendo stuff. I enjoy collecting old Nintendo stuff. Also, quite enjoy collecting old Swatch watches. If I see one in a charity shop for a couple of quid, I pick them up, especially if they're boxed. And I've got a little Swatch collection going on. This is a bit of fun, isn't it? It's just a bit of kind of like,
absolutely,
spot one out in the wild, and it's quite fun to collect. And people are into all sorts of things. If old mobile phones is your jam, then you go for it. You're not harming anyone.
Absolutely right. You said one man's trash is another man's treasure. Simon, stat of the week.
£2.2 trillion. This is the record amount in cash that savers are sitting on, despite the Chancellor's efforts to persuade more households to invest, as we were discussing earlier. This is some analysis of Bank of England statistics by financial services firm Bowmore Wealth Group. 2.2 trillion. Imagine what we could do if people put that 2.2 trillion to work instead of building up more and more cash. And to repeat an old point of mine that I've made many, many times, I think this is an indication that what we are doing in this country in terms of making people with money feel poor, which they are not, is not working, and it is time to change the strategy.
All right then, on that note, Lee, thank you. Simon, thank you. Thank you for listening. That is it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon,
you can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, join in the debate in reader comments. And email us. Tell us if you collect something weird,
do,
or offbeat or unusual. Email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. We want to know about what you collect and why.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.